You're listening to Enthusiasts, a podcast about the most passionate of passionate people. Link in episode description to check out the back catalog, learn more about the show, and check out my other show, 17 Karat K-Pop. This series of episodes tackles themes including depression, suicide, and substance abuse. Please take care when listening, and know the help is out there. Visit NAMI.org, N-A-M-I. Receive more localized support through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 1-800-662-4357. You could also call to talk anytime to a suicide crisis hotline, 1-800-273-8255. Don't want to call? You can text someone. Get 24/7 crisis counselor support, 741-741. You're listening to a series of episodes about the life and legacy of Tony Hsieh. I highly recommend you check out the past parts of this story if you haven't yet. The link is in the episode description. Enjoy the show! Now let's talk about Zappos's early years. This followed the dot-com bubble popping in 2000. Capital dried up, the heydays of big lavish parties were over, the stocks took a hit, Zappos had layoffs, and just cut paychecks for everyone. Things were tough. Tony was frank with Zappos employees that this might flop. Quote, "We are unprofitable with very limited cash. We are in a race against time," unquote. So Tony feverishly put his own money into Zappos and gave up Club Bio, sold other property for less than what he'd paid for them. They also made some quick cash with poker, day trading, various investments paying off, and by selling, for a hefty sum, very in-demand internet domain names like drugs.com. $6 million and 11 property sales later, Zappos was maybe gonna make it. By the end of 2001, Zappos sales quadrupled to 8.6 million. But they were back in trouble. But Tony refused to let business get in the way of a good time, so he did not postpone his trip to Mount Kilimanjaro. Yes, while climbing a mountain, he got a phone call about the buyer backed out last minute. In 24 hours, this business could be over. They eventually did find a buyer who went through with it. And by the end of the year, Zappos' revenue was $32 million. So lots of close calls, but Zappos continued, with Eileen joining in 2002 and realizing just how humble this guy was and feeling maternal towards him being much older. He liked to hang around a very young crew. Backing up a little bit to a side story that will become more of a main story later, January 2001, Mimi Pham and her boyfriend were arrested. She was arrested just for being in the car at the time of the illegal MDMA sale. Her boyfriend sold MDMA to an undercover cop. The conviction would be dismissed later under a new expungement law, but not till 2016. Moving to 2003, Vegas needed a rebranding. They needed new energy, new life. So the "What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas" catchphrase became their official motto. 2003 was also the year Zappos ended with $70 million in gross sales. If you thought the culture at Link Exchange was fun, that's nothing. You've got to hear about Zappos and what it was like to work for the shoe store. Zappos was designed with fun and happiness in mind. Those are the big goals. Prioritize the customer and prioritize just your own joy. Nothing was supposed to be too serious or buttoned up. The main building even had a wall where if you were caught wearing a tie, gotta take it off, add it to the wall art, which kind of formed a flower. So very intentionally non-conventional. Screwing all norms, just being creative and fun and goofy. And it was all about what they wanted at work. So Tony asked around, and their input was narrowed down by him into a list of 10 Zappos principles, including create fun and a little weirdness, build a positive team and family spirit, and deliver wow through service. They always talked about delivering a wow moment for customers. The job interview process included things like a shoe-themed maze and puzzles. You also had to really stand out in your interview because so many people applied every year. Tyler Williams stood out after he sent in a music video where he cloned himself and sang an original Zappos song. He was then hired as a fungineer. So Tony would just pitch, "Hey, wouldn't this be cool?" And Tyler would create it. Tony was like, "Wouldn't this be cool if I had like a jacket that had the ability to light up?" So he built one. Tony also went to Tyler with an idea for a porta party. Porta potties with selfie ability in motorized feet to move around like a mobile party bus toilet. The promo video includes a user of this thing they actually built, saying, quote, "Zappos is always making things fun, and now I'm excited about the toilet," unquote. Tony also said ideas for Mark, telling Mark to put together a Zappos University product. When Mark was like, "What's Zappos University?" Tony was like, "You tell me. You figure it out. It's whatever you want it to be." And it became this mix of professional development opportunities and incentive structures, like pay bumps if you did volunteer work. So everyone would get these random tasks for how to keep this place as fun and beneficial as possible. They had dress-up days like Toga Days, Superhero Week, Tutu Tuesday. People DIY'd their desk areas, dressed super casual. Pets were allowed. There was a nap pod, an employee library. Fun surprise announcements like you guys get leap day off, a ball pit, toy cars racing each other, not an abnormal sight to see people playing with toys. They also had this TV screen in the elevator, so you could play a touchscreen video game there. It was so smart because the goal was that you would get distracted and end up on the wrong floor. So those are your ultimate collisions, right? Those wouldn't happen otherwise, running into people, sharing ideas, moments. Other tech companies have done this too, where they prioritize collisions over convenience. Like, they spread out where to find a bathroom and stuff, because they want you to have to walk by and engage with the other people. Perhaps the most incredible, giving, happy part of Zappos, though, was the call center. Zappos offered so much for customers. That was new at the time. 365-day service, free returns. A lot of companies prioritize quantity over quality, so the more calls you address in a day, the better. They took the opposite approach. The more time you spent on the phone with a customer, it was viewed as actually helping more secure their long-term loyalty. They would talk to you about your day, things beyond your inquiry. An employee famously once spent, I kid you not, 10 hours letting a customer talk to them about their life story, basically. It was so the customer is always right. Everyone did this. Everyone had call center hours, at least during the holiday rush. Even Tony wasn't exempt from that. So he'd work the phones, talk to customers who then would feel this emotional attachment to this brand, and it did pay off in sales. They did cultivate a special kind of fan base because they connected with people one-on-one. One time Tony had a convo going deep on quantum dynamics with a random caller. One time Tony called, like, as a prank, being like, "Where are the pizza shops that are still open right now? Where are the closest ones?" But without missing a beat, the Zappos employee looked it up and told him. So it was less of a customer service call center, more of like a Yellow Pages. Some of Tony's arguments were detailed in the Harvard Business Review. Quote, "Our philosophy has been that most of the money we might ordinarily have spent on advertising should be invested in customer service, so that our customers will do the marketing for us through word of mouth. Usually when marketing departments do their ROI, return on investment, calculations, they assume that the lifetime value of a customer is fixed. We view it as something that can grow if we create positive emotional associations with our brand. The telephone is one of the best branding devices out there. You have the customer's undivided attention, and if you get the interaction right, the customer remembers the experience for a very long time and tells his or her friends about it. We put our phone number at the top of every single page of our website because we actually want to talk to our customers, and we staff our call center 24/7. One customer ended up saying she had a death of a loved one recently, so they sent her flowers," unquote. He was also just the nicest person ever to team members. He loved taking everyone to events, like in his bus, like a party bus to sports games. He would surprise people with VIP concert ticket upgrades, special exclusive after party invites or tips for getting into the after party. He threw a going away party for an employee who was leaving by arranging for him to throw out a first pitch at an MLB game. He would make sure employees of maybe lower status in the company were still let in, so if it was like leaders-only events, he wouldn't have it. When people were in town for his yearly New Year's Eve pajama party, he made sure they had a place to stay, even if the hotels were booked up. He would bring things for people, like when they had a photo shoot and had to wear black jeans, he brought extra pairs in case, and sure enough, someone didn't own any. So as he wanted people to go above and beyond for customers, he also went above and beyond for them. The OG goal was actually to inspire and be inspired, but it changed to deliver happiness. He wanted to make the goal less individualistic. Here's another "it would only happen there" anecdote from a book about Tony's businesses. Quote, in an awkward Q&A, a Zappos employee wearing pajamas asked a series of company origin questions, asked Fred how he would describe his current duties under the title "No Title," to which he responded, "It's a wonderful life," unquote. Tony really prioritized keeping the call center in-house, not outsourcing. That might have been cheaper, but he wanted the U.S. culture references and language nuances to allow for a stronger connection with customers. Quote, how would they be able to help a customer who asked, say, for shoes like the ones Julia Roberts wears in Eat, Pray, Love? Then there was even wilder worthy parties, both vendor appreciation parties and the all-hands meetings, which basically were parties. And Tony kept them secret, the theme, the musical guests, all of it. So you just showed up and it was a surprise party that Tony had planned out like he was president of a prom committee. These were elaborate, detailed meetings, so-called meetings. Very inspired, it seems, by those big .com extra showcases. One of these pep rallies of sorts was a wedding-themed one. That was when the deal closed with Amazon. One involved the "I'm gonna let you finish" Grammy moment, acted out as a skit. Yeah, I don't know. So there were theatrical bits. Vendor parties had variety show elements, penguins, live animals. He loved llamas. Really, really, really. Like, obsessed with llamas. He thought they were so funny. He had a pet one named Marley. They were at company parties. A Zapponians, as they called themselves, catchphrase was "llamas live." Tony also wanted to buy property that from Google Earth would resemble a llama head. The thoughtfulness was again not just silliness, but seriousness too, thinking strategically and business-wise, and mixing that with just goodwill. For example, at the vendor parties, employees were never allowed to cut the line. Sorry, just like our vendors, you are getting in line like the rest of them. All treated the same, and I don't want to see a single vendor carrying their own bag. A lot of people recall these types of events, these big settings, as where they first met Tony, and they sort of just instantly were drawn to him and became friends. He kind of brought you into the fold automatically. One comment from a senior Zappos executive to an author about Tony said something that seemed to be a dark foreshadowing, though, that Tony seemed to want to hire at Zappos, quote, B-minus to C students, unquote, people with less opportunity, less doors open to them. So when that happens, when you're given more of a sense of power and autonomy than you would as part of a traditional company, the flip side is you also might feel like, who do you go to when you want advice from a higher up? Or how do you know when to decipher when to follow someone's lead who's leading? Just something to think about for later in the story. Moving on to 2005. Tony and Mimi Pham met at a shoe conference. Mimi is a character you'll definitely be hearing about more and more as the story unfolds. No one knew she would eventually become such a right-hand person, an assistant in charge of everything for Tony. Finances, grocery shopping, you name it. They would later even share documentation, like they had the same address on their driver's licenses, same phone number, and some of Tony's utility services were under Mimi's name. There have always been times of deep reflection on happiness, where it comes from, how to get it, and just satisfaction, life fulfillment. The aughts were no different. In 2006, Jonathan Haidt released The Happiness Hypothesis, which mixes modern and ancient philosophical, psychological concepts to try to summarize and understand 10 key ideas, 10 key underlying beliefs that relate to how to live a happy, fulfilling life. Spoiler alert, go to the last chapter, and it's pretty much summed up as the joy came from a yin and yang, a balancing of all the things the previous chapters discussed. Companies really started to tap into this market for personal, improved satisfaction. The chief happiness officer was no longer just a weird gimmicky oddity, but companies really did invest in wellness, or at least talk the talk. McDonald's officially announced Ronald McDonald is their chief happiness officer. One Google position is the Jolly Good Fellow. Companies have really tried to hire, or like I said, at least talk the talk, of positive psychologist recommendations, ideals. Positive psychology became a whole subset of psychology more than ever at this time. This also coincided with the rise of TED Talk popularity via YouTube and the surge in sales for all kinds of self-help books. One book at this time is a historian's take on the happiness market, the true industry of it, the selling of it. It's called Happier? And it references a study by Philip Brickman. Brickman, back in the 70s, described this hedonic treadmill, a concept of happiness being elusive when you're trying so hard, so consciously, to cultivate it. And actually, there are famous experiments I will link to with my other sources on my site, where the people who were tasked with thinking happy thoughts ended up more sad than those who didn't. For example, one group watched a happy video, a video meant to spark joy, after reading an article about happiness. The group who didn't read the article first and just watched the video ended up being happier, reporting a better feeling of happiness. There are actually studies as well that show a preoccupation, a fixation on happiness, tends to be found in people who have negative health conditions. They deal with severe loneliness, other mental health issues. So it can actually be counterintuitive to so overtly prioritize it. The more you think about it, the less happy you might actually be because your expectations now are raised and defined rather than just letting happiness come to you in surprising, undefined at first ways. When you put terms to happiness, you end up putting restrictions, limitations on your conceptualization of it. So basically, this era was full of a rise in interest in how to create happiness, but obviously it did not create a happier world. Maybe for some, but like that book said about a need for a yin and yang, the increased focus on the rainbow did not get rid of the rain. The Happiness Hypothesis is one of the books in the style that Tony Hsieh took tons of inspo from that helped create and solidify Zappos' 10 core values in 2006. They also established the 4 C's to follow: commerce, customer service, company culture, community. Other recommended reading was The Slay Edge, Turning Simple Disciplines into Massive Success and Happiness. Tony also recommended Stealing Fire, How Silicon Valley, the Navy SEALs, and Maverick Scientists are Revolutionizing the Way We Live. That one talks about ecstasis, this state of a group of people getting that hive mind Tony craved in the rave setting, when it's like your consciousness switches off and is replaced with this big, almost superhuman, united, synced up consciousness. He also recommended, and actually made some employees, as part of their initiation, read this book called The Fred Factor. No, it was not about Fred Mossler, one of his business partners. The Fred Factor is essentially a tale of finding joy in a mundane job. 2007, Amazon saw the traction online shoe sales were getting and wanted to copy it, which they did, launching Endless.com, basically a Zappos knockoff, that promised similar customer perks and values. That was also the year that Zappos, after 8 years of trying, finally succeeded, landing a deal with Nike. They all celebrated together, as was their custom, so every department got to close down for the day, and they ran up an actually official historic bar tab for a nearby restaurant. They all got to celebrate this big win. In 2008, Zappos hit $1 billion in gross merchandise sales for the first time. This was also the year of the recession. So while Zappos is thriving, meanwhile in Vegas, things aren't going so well. Tourism is one of the first to be hard hit as an industry in times of financial dire straits. However, kind of similar to the Park City story, people really teamed up to make do with what they had. So reuse, adaptive reuse, became a go-to more than ever. Repurposing signs, repurposing buildings, giving makeovers to old and worn down things instead of buying new material. They were also able to capitalize on current housing trends in terms of what people wanted. Walkability, like the 15-minute city concept that still has some momentum behind it today. and people wanted more of a sense of community, those incentivized them to further redesign Vegas and make it an appealing place to be, aside from the obvious reasons people go to Vegas. In 2008 and 2009, Tony was inspired by Vegas. Wherever people have seen something run down, Tony has seen opportunity, and he saw the chance to do what he loved, starting something new, starting a brand new high-stakes project with big tangible outcomes. This was also around the time the Neon Reverb Fest started, which really influenced him as well. And the team behind the fest would later hope to partner on Tony's big plans to boost local music acts. Tony had several big, influential meetings in Vegas at this time that got his mind really going. One person was Michael Cornthwaite, who introduced him to the area. Another influential figure, the author of Triumph of the City. Tony loved this book so much, he actually called the author, enthusiastically peppering him with so many questions, and even proposing that his dad could translate it into Mandarin. He then convinced the author to go on a tour with him in Vegas and consult, answer more of his questions in person. And then he talked to Oscar Goodman and his wife, Carolyn. The Goodmans ran Vegas. Oscar Goodman was the mayor, who had been instituting lots of revitalization efforts. The missing piece was still bringing jobs to the area. They could bring an aesthetic cleanup, but still bringing careers to get people to move there was the missing piece. Which is when Andrew Donner, a guy in real estate, told Goodman, hey, Zappos is interested in relocating. In April 2009, Tony gave a presentation to Jeff Bezos. He was talking about Zappos' values and way of talking about and creating happiness. Bezos interrupted the presentation to say, did you know, people aren't really good at predicting what will make them really happy. Tony replied with something to the effect of, I did know that, and apparently you knew how to predict a slide, because his next PowerPoint slide pretty much verbatim said what Bezos just said. Did you know that people don't know what will make them happy? So they really hit it off. They were on the same wavelength. And Bezos made a special video internally for the company, really praising Tony and his colleagues. He really seemed so taken by Tony's vision and belief in employee happiness and sales growth not being mutually exclusive, in fact, the opposite. Bezos said in the video, quote, I've seen a lot of leaders of companies, and I haven't seen any better than those three. That culture and the Zappos brand are huge assets that I value very much, and I want those things to continue, unquote. They had another big business meeting, Tony and his colleagues, with Bezos, that followed the two pizza rule. That's a rule where you should try to avoid having more people at a meeting than would be served by two orders of pizza. It turned out to be an effective theory in this case, the right amount of people at the meeting. Fred Mosler recalls their big day. Quote, at 8 a.m., we met the guy who drew on the whiteboard in the famous UPS commercials. We had lunch with Tony Robbins, we had dinner with Jeff Bezos, and closed the day with Snoop Dogg. Unquote. Two major things were about to happen. One, Zappos planned to buy vacant City Hall in Vegas and make that their new headquarters. And they were sold to Amazon. So at age 35, Tony sold Zappos to Amazon in a deal worth $1.2 billion with a B dollars. Quite an interesting side story here from the tour Tony went on in the spring of 2010. He wrote a book called Delivering Happiness, A Path to Profits, Passion, and Purpose. He wrote it in 24-hour binges and wanted to make it accessible to anyone. He really didn't believe in hiding trade secrets or anything. Like, he didn't even care if direct competition took from his ideas. So when Amazon would go on to launch that copycat site, when they later on adopted more Zappos ideas like paying to quit policies to cut down on new applicants, he didn't care if he got credit for his idea. He was excited to just see the idea be enacted. So anyway, this business guidebook slash memoir topped the New York Times bestsellers list for 28 consecutive weeks. It got a big fan in Reggie Love, a Barack Obama aide. Tony got Love a copy, hoping he would pass it along to Obama. Reggie Love later messaged him admitting, it didn't go to Obama yet because I was glued to it and I couldn't put it down, so I had to finish first. He went on a speaking tour for the book that was really as quirky and strange of an adventure as his Zappos stuff is, and Link Exchange, Venture Frogs, everything he did. To put it mildly, the bus tour members were clashing often. The dynamics were strange. They often didn't get along. But Tony tried to keep everything super happy and fun. They bought a bus that they gave a makeover for this tour from the Dave Matthews Band. They also had a full-time bartender on the bus. They were drinking a lot, and they stopped in different cities, not just for these speeches, but just hangouts with local residents. Happy hour time with them, sack races, hula hooping. They did some random dares, like one time Tony dared one of them to try to fit inside a giant merch bag. They then carried that person in that bag down the hall. One time he said, "Why don't we, down the row, mouth to mouth pass the shot?" Ew. The bus all the time had to be full of happy music. Tony did play All I Want for Christmas Is You year-round. He loved, loved, loved happy music. And he loved the two-man band Rabbit, who played for them on the bus, with a keyboard resembling a cat that played meowzik for them. There was a little bit of a homework assignment for the bus tour mates. Tony sent them an email, as he often did, writing instead of talking, telling people face-to-face what he wanted to express. He told them, first, make a list of people you like connecting with. Then make a list of people who annoy you. Then list your happiest memories. Then list your least happiest memories. So what were they to do with this info? He ended that email with, quote, "Get ready for step two," unquote. That never came. He never brought up this exercise again. He got bored, I guess, and moved on to his next idea for team building. The book was a huge hit and led to a same-titled Delivering Happiness consultancy service. He co-founded it with Jen Lim, and Jen was the face, the non-shy head of the company. So in press for the consultancy, Jen took the lead. They scored big-name clients, including McDonald's, Starbucks, Sallie Mae, and over 300 others. Some, like Century 21, adopted their policies but personalized them. Like, that company did a campaign about flourishing rather than happiness, so they changed the wording. But again, Tony didn't seem to mind what might seem like copying to others. He was not competitive. Position titles at this first-ever culture coach consulting firm, as they called it, included Win-Win-Win, Collaboration Booster, and Happiness Owl. So it was Tony's take on the trend of happiness CEO-type appointments. The tour was a classic mix of Tony's mix of fun and smarts, good marketing and just playfulness, working and playing nonstop, being social and being introverted. It was all classic Tony, and that mix would definitely lead to some interesting results as the move to City Hall took place. When employees found out about the headquarters moving to Vegas, it was kind of sudden, but they were offered lots of help. The company would help with moving costs, assistance finding a new place to live, and they offered generous severance for anyone who chose to just quit the job instead. They expected maybe half of the 90 employees to go with them, but 70 ended up moving with them. 70 out of 90 relocated for Tony's business, ready to follow his lead. As Tony put it in the Harvard Business Review, quote, "When we arrived, we had no one to lean on except one another. Our company culture, which had always been strong, became even more so. As we grew, we made sure we hired only people who would enjoy hanging out after hours. Many of our best ideas arose while we were having drinks at a local bar." Unquote. What stands out to me in hindsight is that part where he said they had no one to lean on but each other. So this culture-creating group grew stronger together, but some big caveats were on the horizon. Despite Tony's desire to kind of be a backroom observer, he was jokingly dubbed the mayor of downtown Vegas, leading this renovation. The way he could generate people to move somewhere, that's a big deal to have that kind of sway. Tony had been thinking not just about what employees wanted abstractly, but tangibly. What an ideal makeover for a canvas would be. He toured quite a few company spaces and reflected on what he liked and didn't like about how they ran stuff. One particular thing he wanted to adopt from places like Apple was that collision potential, architecturally setting things up to force people to crash into each other, interact during the day at unexpected times. He also was still focused on that New York City vibe. One part of your life seems to be right next to other parts of it with no clear isolating variable. Tony actually considered different headquarters relocations, but Vegas was ultimately chosen because, no surprise, he thought it would be the happiest place for his employees to be. I should also add, though, I think a lack of Nevada's income tax also contributed. Before the ultimate Vegas makeover, a few key things happened in 2011. One, Tony attended his first Burning Man, the festival that became his new favorite thing. He later wrote about feeling like he shifted from the default world into another headspace entirely, another plane mentally, doing drugs at Burning Man. 2011 was when a book called The Lean Startup came out. It was developed by an entrepreneur, Eric Ries, who popularized in the Silicon Valley world, the West Coast tech and entrepreneurial scenes, failing fast. The lean-in movement he led has been now implemented by everyone from General Electric to enterprises in the UAE. The goal is kind of similar in some ways to the holacracy ideas, because he had a stop the line idea. Stop the line meaning anyone in your metaphorical or literal assembly line could stop the whole course of action with the same amount of power and leverage. The ultimate summary of his theory, the lean-in movement mentality, is that you should just keep moving fast and breaking stuff. Quickly, 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 run through ideas and figure out what's working, ditch what isn't, at a rapid clip. Because he argued, really, the issue is not the ideas of the products as much as it is just market unpredictability. Like, when is the right moment to pitch your product? You don't know, so you better get different products for different times already at any moment. A bunch of mini trial tests is the way to do stuff. One example would be BlueSpark. This guy, Paul Howe, wanted to test out this app, maybe add it to Facebook's capabilities. So we kind of just saw if people would be interested with a trial run. And they weren't really, so he scrapped the idea. Therefore, he didn't go further down an unsuccessful path that would lose him more money. So when others, who were slow and steady, were still raising money to try out certain ideas, he'd moved on to the next thing. So he was ahead of the game. It's all about being ahead of them. There are, of course, big issues opponents have with this. One being things like the Macintosh. That's something that actually flopped at first, kind of. It really, really became mainstream and popular with a lot of time and gradual word of mouth. Those types of massive innovations don't benefit from a move fast and if it isn't working, don't be patient mentality. And of course, it also brings into question how much you're going to pay attention to who is left in the wake. As you quick move fast and break stuff, who cleans up the wreck? What is happening to people and things that you quickly discarded? Lastly, from 2011, Tony's brother Andy tried to make it himself in startup land with Lux Deluxe. Lux Deluxe was a service to connect wealthy buyers with home sellers. It started out invite only, but then there was an issue because if it's invite only, you can't grow. But when you make it open to all, you get rid of the cool elite exclusivity of it all. So the liaison role in home sales didn't really pan out. So the company totally pivoted to food delivery in 2013. That didn't really take off either, so Andy abandoned the company in 2016, citing a desire to just stop commuting and spend more time with family. He had said at that point it would stay operational, but all signs it was operational still were gone by the end of 2017. Andy tried again to succeed with the company Sweet Hall in 2019, but that didn't really work out either. Meanwhile, while his brother was trying to do what was trendy and striking out, a flash mob was brought into City Hall as part of Zappos' campaign to make their headquarters switch and another new project official. And the unconventional Tony, to say the least, was preparing a massive, risky, very, very, very unconventional project that Zappos would be the hub of, the central hub, but not just that would change, the whole town of Vegas, the whole surrounding area, he was ready to completely overhaul. In January 2012, the big idea was revealed. Tony was set to lead the downtown project, aka DTP. The goal was to completely, top to bottom, transform downtown Vegas. He wanted it to be a city as a startup. That's his word choice. And the happiest place in the world. The happiest city in the world. The most communal, co-working capital of the world. A super community-oriented, refurbished, innovative, super happy hub. Like if Zappos was a whole town. People who wanted to move there and help start businesses for the DTP just had to ask and lay out their plan, and Tony would write him a check and say, go nuts. The whole project was set to span 5 years. 5 years to turn a worn down town into the happiest, most vibrant community on earth. One of the ways to do that was with value on ROC, not just ROI. Companies tend to like ROI, return on investment, but Tony wanted to focus on ROC, return on community. He also thought about ROL, return on luck, referring to those spontaneous collisions where magic would happen as creative minds ran into each other. To the point it was a safety hazard, with Tony boldly saying in an interview, quote, we actually shut down most of the doors and forced employees through a single door in order to get more collisions, unquote. Sounds like a fire hazard to me, but I digress. ROL is a term he got from the author Jim Collins from the book Great by Choice. So this was a very intentional by choice way to generate a sense of luck, fortuitousness, joy, all of that. Tony was now super wealthy, so he was going to invest $350 million of his own money into the DTP. $50 million allocated for small business owners, $50 million for art and culture projects, and $50 million for tech startup investments. The rest would be buying up land and high-rises. Because yep, like in his earlier years, he wanted to buy living space to live among his coworkers slash friends. At the DTP, there was a lot going on, aesthetically. Lots of art sculptures, giant quirky statues, one of the most famous being this big praying mantis statue. There was doggy daycare, no traditional office space. Now it was just going to a bar for meetings to talk business. There was a convenience store formerly converted into a theater for TED Talk-like speeches. There was Container Park, a bunch of 40-foot shipping containers converted into bars, restaurants, businesses, with a playground in the middle, and an Alice in Wonderland source of inspiration for parts of the art displays. The thought was you could go get a drink, and your kid could go to the central playground that also had a big treehouse. There were big monthly block parties. They were going to do something with Teslas too, but that was a short-lived idea. However, he did order 100, despite them never being used for anything. They displayed tons of mutant vehicles, like Transformers basically, a popular idea from Burning Man. And had an official agreement where Burning Man would provide artwork for the area, and also help consult on the first Friday block parties, attended by tens of thousands. They had drum circles, a burning of their own, of a statue, of a Vegas showgirl, and it overall screamed, Tony did this. Not every idea came about. The skating rink did not happen, the magic castle, the traveling magic axe, but many things did. There was Rocketeer, ROC-a-tier, like the ROC acronym, a mentorship service. There was Eat, a restaurant that got super big and really helped Natalie Yun find a new zest for life. After years of addiction, she went on to start her own restaurant, a dream of hers. She first met Tony, said, hi, I'm Natalie, and he just said, I know who you are, what size restaurant you want, and he wrote her a check. She went on also to start a program for at-risk youth called Chow to the Core. Another person who made hay with the opportunities Tony's money afforded her was Jen McCobb of Factorly. Factorly was Kinko's for printing, 3D printing, and whatever you wanted printed. Even Obama cited it in a speech as a symbol of American innovation and the entrepreneurial spirit. Jen moved to San Francisco because she just trusted him so much. Tony invested $10 million so she could set up a 25,000 square foot facility. This was after he told her, look, take 90 days first and do nothing but write down all your ideas for a startup in a notebook. No strings attached. What would your startup be? She went on to invest in 6 companies in 6 weeks, then 24 companies across 4 months. She described her experience as a spirit walk and a vision quest. Like she felt like truly a fateful, cosmic, spiritual awakening had come to her with this transformative opportunity. And she recalls, quote, "He looked at me seriously, and when he laser focuses in, when he speaks in that way, you absolutely know it'll work out," unquote. People got to start whatever idea they could come up with. They excitedly did so, and got to keep the fun going in apartments too. Tony rented out 50, actually, for many friends, converting his into the jungle room. He also had a movie room. He liked themed areas. No boring decor. Another replication from his past businesses was having employees list their values. So we had them fill out worksheets, DTP people, so we could compile and assess what they had written. In maybe a dark sign of foreshadowing, Maggie Hsu recalled Tony saying, "I'm not sure this should fit on the list," when integrity was included. She later said he explained, "I view that as a meta value, not a regular value, so that's why I didn't need to be on the list, like it was a given." But that questioning the value of integrity gave her pause. Still, hopes were super high, and the mayor was so behind this project, comparing Tony to Howard Hughes. So I have to do an aside now about Howard Hughes' fascinating life. Let's pause here and get ready for the next chapter of this story, coming very soon. Be sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it.